talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
Hello. Привет. Добрый день. Па-вака. Хуйен абонд. Алоха. Ола. Ола, джамбо. Ассаламу алейкум. Со карес. Бонжорно. Алло, чефач. Здрасти. Йоу, добрый утро, добрый вечер, добрый день. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good whatever. I am your host. Good night. The Right Reverend, Dr. Rowe. And you are listening to me on revolution.radiofreedomslips.com. Excuse me. Stroh, my goodness, strawberry kush, I tell you. Okay. So is anybody, I'm just curious, anybody out there in the chat room anywhere actually know what Socares means? That's a trivia question. Does anybody know what language that is when I say Socares? Usually it's Socares, Socares. But you could say, so, Cares. Tell me if you know what that means. Come in the chat room. We have a chat room at chatsy.com/freedomslips. And in that chat room, we have a lot of chatters. I'm going to go there and say hello to all of our friends there in the chat room. Comment. Comment is in the chat room. Jim Bob, Big D, 1955, a mesmery, Stardust Man, Zippy 101. Dirt Engineer, Driver Dan. I always want to say Diver Dan, but I'm looking, I see an R. So it's not Diver, it's Driver. Driver Dan, Wild Bob, up in the wilds, somewhere in the great American expanse of the wilderness, there is Wild Bob. Cat Dog Girl, Tootsie, Choppy Water. We have SJ, Mona Rattler, the Silver Hammerhead, Dry Fly Guy, Monster 383, Saul Rosenberg, Zip Diddy 5. I see Wally in our chat room, as well as Sassy Ass and Sin Sue, Popsicle Toes, Eagle Flower, Boy Solomon, Jer Bear, Noreen, Batsman, Surrey Sunflower, Nasomania, Festus B, and May Street 139. Where'd the metal rabbit go? He's following Mario around. All right. So we're moving on into the weekend. The weather is starting to warm up. No, don't sing, please. Oh, it must be talking to Studio A. Yes. So Strawberry Tush is also in the chat room as well. I have a Fulford report. Ben sent it on, and so I do have the Fulford report, so we'll do that today. We have a little bit of an intel update, and then I guess, and some miscellaneous stuff, and I guess we'll probably finish up the second hour with some 1984 from the audio that we had started. I think we're about 250 minutes in, if I'm correct. Okay, so... Where to begin? You know, I had to re-aim my satellite dish today. Not that I actually watch too much TV, but every once in a while, figure if I'm paying for it, might as well make use of it once in a blue moon. You know, sometimes I like to turn on the music. All right, so cryptocurrencies, let's start there. Let's start with insanity. That is Dogecoin, 57 cents right now, and it's actually down 11% in 24 hours. We're in a red slump right now. Oh, noes. Even though we're hitting all-time highs for several coins, Ethereum just keeps bumping against those all-time highs at $3,481 right now. $3,481 for Ethereum. Bitcoin still hovering around $56,000. That's okay. $56,250 for Bitcoin. BNB, $630. Dogecoin, 57 cents. XRP is 158. And finally, Cardano has overtaken XRP, trading at 167 right now. Cardano, 167 right now. All-time high. All-time high for Cardano. Polkadot, 41.29, Bitcoin Cash, $1,473. $1,473. This hasn't been this high in quite a while. Litecoin also hitting all-time highs, currently trading right now at $350. Over $350 for Litecoin. Uniswap down just a little bit at $40. Chainlink, 46. And here you go. Didn't I tell you this was going to pop? I told you. This is the one, yes, ETC, Ethereum Classic. ETC trading at $134 right now, up a whopping 43% in the last 24 hours, according to the current metric.
Now, Ethereum Classic is 100% compatible with Ethereum. Ethereum Classic's trading at $135. Ethereum is trading at $3,490. They both do the same thing. Right now, a lot of people don't want to use... it's just a matter of time before Ethereum Classic. It's like the big empty parking lot in the back. And a lot of people understand why it's not being utilized, and a lot of people don't understand. And that's both good and bad, I guess, depending on your perspective. You see, there was a hack a long time ago with the DAO, D-A-O, Decentralized Autonomous Organization. When all this stuff, the smart contracts and all that first started coming out, Ethereum was young, somebody hacked one of the first projects and got away with a lot of Ethereum. At that time, there was no ETC. It was just ETH, ETH. And ETH was trading quite low. I don't even remember what it was, but it might not have been over $2. It might have been somewhere like, yeah, a couple bucks or something. Anyway, so they got hacked. And half or part of the community said, well, there's an easy way to fix this. We'll just roll back time. We'll just, like, basically, you know, the hack happened at, let's say the hack happened at block, you know, 1,500. Well, then we'll go back to block 1,450 so that that block where that hack happened would not have happened. And we'll just roll back the blockchain. And then the another part of the group said, whoa, hold on there, Nelly. You don't just go back in time on a whim. Even this is no, it's the nature of it is non-fungible. The nature of it is immutable. It's not to be changed. And if we sit there and tinker around in the code and reverse time, that's going to like be totally against all the principles that crypto is and what we stand for and we won't have it. And then the argument said, well, then if you allow this to continue, then whoever hacked Ethereum is going to have like millions and millions of dollars worth of tokens. But if we roll back time, the hacker will not have been able to do that because the blocks will go backwards and they won't be able to have their tokens. And the other group said, we don't care. We're not going to change time. We're not going to roll back the blockchain. We're going to leave it as it is. If these things happen, we have to live with them. We're going to continue. We're going to keep going. And so the argument finally came to a head, and they said, well, then we're just fork you. Fork you, and we're going to have a hard fork. And so the folks that wanted to keep things the way they were, that didn't want to adjust anything, those were the classic folks. They said, we're going to keep it the way it is, classic. And the rest of the folks that said, no, the hackers shouldn't be able to just profit because of this. They went on to continue with ETH, and the projects went on with that. Now, it is true that you can lock addresses. You can blacklist addresses on the Ethereum chains. So I haven't been following. I don't know whatever happened. As far as I know, the hacker may still be sitting on his ETC. So the hacker has all his ETC, and well, now it's like $138. So they're probably smiling. But if these addresses are known, you know, there's Tether addresses, these ERC20 addresses can be blacklisted. All right. That's not true for Bitcoin. That's not true for the other coins, but it is true for the Ethereum chain, and it is true for the tokens that run on that chain. One of the truly decentralized projects is going to handle smart contracts and trustless stuff, but it has to be built first. There's got to be somebody that creates this and then sort of releases it and lets it fly by itself. And that is Cardano, ADA. Cardano is working on a system that is going to be, they're literally going to kick it out of their nest when they're done with it. And wash their hands and say, okay, there you go, you know, and let it kind of roll on its own. They're not going to be like, say, EOS.
EOS, which is like, well, you know, we're going to basically be in charge of everything.
And whatever we say goes, and you can't look at our stuff, and blah, 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 blah. We've got a long way to go with a lot of cryptos. Let me see. One more. Let's take a look back down at, well, let's see. Engine coin. Okay, 249. And, of course, Theta Fuel, 38 cents. And where's my Digibyte? Got to see my Digibyte. 14 cents. Okay. Now, there is there is a couple new things just for fun for crypto. Uniswap is now in version 3. What does that mean? Liquidity providers can continue. They can migrate their liquidity from version 2 to version 3 at any time you want. It's going to cost you a little gas. I screwed up and it cost me like $100-something in gas extra. But that's the way things go. Because it depends on how much you got in there and what you're doing. It's a multiple transactions. So anyway, you can choose your range of, price. So if you provide liquidity by putting in some ETH and some UNI, you can say, or Tether or whatever, you can say, well, as long as an ETH is around this and da 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 da, continue to, you know, be active, and then you get the fees, and you get like 0.3% of the fees. So each day you see what your fees, you are collecting fees. Now there's a new decentralized exchange with NFT mechanics. There is a gamified, rewarding, and decentralized AMM exchange, powered by ESW governance token and NFT magic cards. It compensates for 100% Ethereum gas fees. What? That means they pay the gas. That means you don't have to pay any gas. So I'm looking at this. This is emiswap.com. I have nothing to do with this. I'm just, you know, emiswap.com. And then I'm going to check it out here. I hooked up my MetaMask wallet to it just for fun. And you got swap, pool, and invest. Well, I'm going to go look at swap and select a token. There's not very many tokens on there. So you've got, okay, there's mine. And now what do I want to buy? Well, you can only buy ESW, USDC, USDT, and WETH right now. But let's say I wanted to try that. Would give me that blah, blah, 100% gas fee refund. So I could swap it for free. So if I want to, well, that's kind of cool because, you know, you can swap now for a stable coin. So if you want to swap for USDC or Tether and you have some ETH, you can use your MetaMask wallet and ETH in there and swap it basically for free and turn whatever amount. Let's say you need $5, you need $3 in Tether, swap 0.001 ETH, and boom, it'll swap it. And then you have your Tether that goes into your ERC20 MetaMask wallet, of course, that's on your system, and then you can use that for whatever you want. Okay, well, that's nice. Things are evolving. Things are moving along. People are tired of expensive prices for ridiculousness. All right, let's see. What else do we got going on here? Swiss diplomat that was ready to testify against Mr. Biden has mysteriously died. What did they do? Fall out of a window? Let's see. Biden is openly attacking Swiss banks. He made an address to U.S. Congress. This was responded to by FINMA and its spokeswoman, Isabel Roche, firing back. She said to Biden, Switzerland considers this highlighting of Switzerland as a tax haven by the USA as an inappropriate and completely out of date. Switzerland meets all international standards in tax matters. Well, you know, Switzerland used to be supposedly like a tax haven, right? You know, back in like the 1950s. But that's probably where Biden's brain is. Let's see what else they're saying here. Weird translations as usual. A secret Biden prisoner swap with Iran is being talked about and would release $7 billion in frozen Iranian funds. Iranian diplomat Assadollah Assadi in February was convicted in a secret trial he wasn't even allowed to attend. He was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment with a stipulation that orders he cannot be exchanged in a prisoner swap. Well, that kind of sucks, huh? Would you imagine? Now, no, and there's an extra little fine print here that says you can never be exchanged. Huh. Let's see. What is this saying here? Hang on here. Oh, okay. Biden's $90 billion bailout to Iran. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy and Senator Chris Coons are flying all over the Middle East right now, collecting as much money as possible. There was an explosion after midnight from the Kamrenia Towers, which is a high-rise block in northern Tehran, where Swiss diplomat Brunner lives on the 18th floor. 8 hours later, her lifeless body was discovered on the ground outside of this 20-story building by a gardener. So, yes, they were thrown out of a window. I was right. An investigation has found no signs of foul play. No blood in the apartment, no struggles. But, wait. There was a note found. After my death, take my body. The note said, found in her apartment. After my death, take my body back to Switzerland and inform my son. Then, cremate my body and burn it next to my child who died. Moreover, give all my money and everything I have to my other son. Let's see. All right, that was kind of a weird one, but there you have it. All right. Let's kind of clean this up here. See if we've got any other ones. Not really. Nothing that's really of huge importance. I did see something that was kind of interesting. This is by HP. You know, I keep thinking about this great reset, right, that they're going to loft down upon us. And, of course, they've got all the technical big companies are, you know, all on board, right? And I'm pretty sure that they're going to have their little Bilderberg meeting, and then they're going to kind of go over the next phase of whatever it is they're planning, which doesn't seem very good. But there is something that it's put out by HP. And, of course, HP is just one of those big companies. It's doing things like Microsoft and Google, and they all have a little modular part to play. They're all doing their research into many things. We talked about how Microsoft, in a past show, has done extensive research in molecular DNA manipulation, stranding, and putting data into cells and literally creating a computer that works within you. Now you have HP, and they have a project, Sustainable Impact for the Planet. Sense, C, capital C, lowercase e, capital N, capital S, capital E, Sense, C-E-N-S-E. HP's Central Nervous System for the Earth. This is what it means. Central Nervous System for the Earth. Ladies and gentlemen and non-binaries, they do not just want to wire you up with nanotech and craziness. They want to wire up everything. They want to wire up the entire damn planet with their Sano nanotech, insane molecular manipulation. Listen to this. HP Central Nervous System for the Earth is a project of HP Labs. It's revolutionizing the way information is gathered, communicated, and analyzed. Now, we know that, you know, the AI, of course, is there is AI behind the scenes, right? Okay, we'll go on here. Sense consists of a highly intelligent network of billions of nanoscale sensors designed to feel, taste, smell, see, and hear what is going on in the world. When fully deployed, these sensors will quickly gather data and transmit it to powerful computing engines, which will analyze and act upon the information in real time, using a new breed of business applications and web services. Now, that sounds benign enough, doesn't it? Sense combines breakthrough innovations from HP Labs and nanotechnology-enabled sensors, networking, data storage, and computation, business analytics and optimization in ways that could make people and businesses safer, more secure, and more efficient. That's always for that, right? Of course, they wouldn't ever want to do anything to harm anybody. We always want to make sure that everything is as safe, secure as possible, and as efficient as possible. And that is why the world is a wonderland. By providing real-time information on the physical environment, the networks are intended to improve the way governments, businesses, and society respond to and manage environmental, biological, and physical structural changes. Now, you could interpret that in a myriad of ways. Think about it. Let's go over that one more time, class. By providing real-time information, so, okay, it's got every sense that there is, feeling, tasting, smelling, seeing, hearing, touching, all that. Real time going to the powerful computer AI systems intended to improve the way governments like law enforcement, tax collectors, right? You know, all those guys would like to put you in jail or shoot you. Businesses, oh, those are the ones that want to take your money, you know, like the bill collectors and things like that. I want to make sure that you're poor. And society, well, that's everybody else snooping around and making sure that you are conforming and doing what the rest of society thinks you should be doing. Respond to and manage environmental, the world around you, biological, well, you, and physical structural changes, more of the world around you. The very air you breathe. Examples of potential sense uses include roads, buildings, bridges, and other infrastructure. Machines such as those used in airplanes and manufacturing plants and organizations that work on health and safety issues such as the contamination of food and water, disease control, and patient monitoring. Because we know that there's going to be a lot of patients that have diseases that are going to need control. My goodness, it's a pandemic. It's going all over the gosh darn planet. So much so that everybody needs to take a shot. But don't you worry. We've got the highest grade, high technology, science is settled, super duper fantasticalistic shot. You even have a choice. Well, no, you don't. But we've got three. We've got Johnson & Johnson. We got Pfizer. We got Moderna. And some other people actually have AstraZeneca. But don't be jealous. Don't be jealous. We'll give you a booster shot. And it's going to make you feel better. And it's going to make the world a better, safer place for all. Because that is the goal. That is what we want. We want everybody to live happily ever after. Sense will open up a new breed of business optimization applications using information ranging from operating capacity and merchandise tracking to environmental management and safety. The sensors will have the potential to smell a gas leak, monitor the speed and volume of freeway traffic, sense wear and tear on a bridge, or track the spread of the next flu virus. With Sense, organizations can be more effective and use resources more efficiently throughout the global economy. Sense could lead to tenfold gains in production efficiencies and the ability to extend the life of manufacturing components by 50%. That's right.
That Sense, the Central Nervous System for the Earth by HP. Get it today.
So, yeah, I guess Shell is going to use it for a clearer picture of oil and gas reserves. In the first commercial application of Sense technology, HP and Shell will build a wireless sensing system to acquire high-resolution seismic data. By vastly improving the quality of seismic imaging, the new system will allow Shell to more easily and cost-effectively explore difficult oil and gas reservoirs. Well, gosh darn, aren't you impressed? You know, they do have the potential of creating a wonderland. But do you think they're going to do it? Hell no. they probably have already attempted to do it for themselves. Oh, I'm sure that there are some underground bases and special secret places that have interesting spaces for funny smiling faces to have absolutely fantastical times. Just a little wonderlands, little encasements of amazement for the ultra uber rich. There's a building in New York and Manhattan that you have to be a billionaire to walk in the door. I'm serious. I don't know what's in there. Nobody knows what's in there. Only billionaires know what's in there. Yeah, it's true. It's a skyscraper. It's a building. It's a big building. And you have to be a member. And the way you be a member is you have to be a billionaire. Billionaire. And if you're not, then you're not part of the crowd and you're not allowed in. Understand? Thank you very much. Now, if you'd please leave. Let's see. HP Labs, blah, 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 network of tiny cheap. Yes, we know that. Detectors. They're going to put them everywhere. Now, there are some projects that have been worked on by defense corporations that utilize. There's a sector of TRW that's called the microhydraulics section. Or, well, it was, and TRW is no longer a company, actually. But when there was a company called TRW, they had a sector there called the microhydraulics lab. And inside the microhydraulics lab, they created machines. Really, really, really tiny machines. Now, they were not nano machines. They were everything above the nano scale. Now, what is that? That would be a V8 engine block that's fully functional that fits on the head of a pin. That would be a completely fully functional model of, let's say an Apache helicopter that fits on a dime. The type of precision and intricacy that is beyond a watchmaker that may even start out at a nanoscale, but the components, the machines themselves are just really tiny, but not. Now, what were these machines used for? What were they exploring? What were some of the use case applications that the white paper, the call for papers from the Defense Advanced Research Product Agency, what did they want those things to do? They wanted machines that could follow wires. They wanted machines that could actually crawl through literally crawl through wires, electrical wires, bore into a wire. Not the actual copper, but let's say the rubber insulation, the casing, and then crawl and just worm its way through the wire that's hot and then pop out somewhere and manipulate things physically. Now take that to the nanoscale, which is at a scale where molecular constructs interact completely different than they do on the macro scale, on the physical level that you and I are used to. When you're dealing with something at microhydraulics, gold still is gold, silver still is silver, wood is still wood, oil is still oil. Things respond and interact the way that they normally would if they were in the larger world,
They're just really, really tiny. When you're talking about nanotechnology, okay, I'm getting messages here. When you're talking about nanotechnology, you're talking completely different rules of physics, literally. That you can molecularly bond different components and make things that do not exist in the natural world. Like you can bond aluminum to wood. And you can have a wooden aluminum form of something. Gold behaves differently at that scale. So what's the point? What am I trying to say? Is that the things that they're working on at the nanoscale now, I mean, the sky is the limit. They have nano components now that are so sophisticated when they go inside of you, they can literally attach themselves between, well, they can intercept the synaptic firings between, you know, the neurons, between your brain synapses, the neurons, they can intercept them. It's like think of a network sniffer, like Wireshark or something. That's, you're doing a man in the middle attack. The hackers know what that is. A man in the middle attack. Let's say somebody at point A is sending data to point B. Well, the man in the middle between A and B is something that shouldn't be there. That's maybe just listening. So it's just scooping the data up and listening while it goes by, copying. Or even worse, scooping data up, changing it in real time and sending it on to its destination. So now the A becomes a B and the B becomes a C. And you're just, you know, the man in the middle is doing. What's to say that you can't have massive amounts of nanotechnology that's doing that very thing, becoming a man in the middle between you and reality? You don't even know it's real anymore. The very synaptic firings in your brain could be manipulated with nanotechnology. Now, I'm not saying that that's what's in this sleever thing, jab, vaccine, whatever the hell you want to call it. Stuff that they're putting in needles. I don't know. That's part of the problem. I don't know what's in there, but they do say there is some DNA stuff. And that is a nano level. As some of the folks have looked at this in labs, uttering the words Morgellons, looking at these things under a high powered microscope, watching what appear to be biological moving objects encased within the Pfizer vaccine. I can't explain that. I never saw them make it. Did you see them make it? You trust them? So that's sense. Is it common sense? That's HP sense. C-E-N-S-E. You can look that up if you want. You know what? That was back from 2009. Boom. There you go. Dropping one on you. You thought that was recent, didn't you? Didn't you? That was from 2009. Well over a decade ago. You think they've made any progress by then? Hell, they're ready for the rollout. That's what they're doing. They've got a production line. We have gone live. And we've already injected millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people. Get ready for the show of a lifetime. It's going to be quite interesting, I think. The Fulford Report does not necessarily recommend or does not necessarily reflect the views of Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, or myself or any of its appendages, although there are parts in there we might or might not agree with. It's by definition the Fulford Report by Benjamin Fulford. But before I do that, let me go over to the chat room and answer some questions. Susie Q has put a question in the chat room. Let's see. Says, Mr. Rowe, what is your favorite exchange for crypto? If you want to move crypto from your wallet and transfer it to cash in your bank account, you must use an exchange, correct? Yes, for the most part, that is correct. What is my favorite? Well, I would say that being in America,
unfortunately, we're limited. So, but we have a couple of them. And out of them, the two that I would say are my, well, my favorite one, I think, that does the fastest as far as like moving money from crypto into your bank would be Binance.us. Second after Binance.us would be Gemini.com. Now, and then I also recommend having an account on Kraken.com. And as an American, because you're limited to pairs, those three are going to give you most of what you might need. Kraken doesn't have a direct bank deposit thing. I cannot understand why for the life of me, because they are actually a full-fledged bank, the first crypto exchange to become one, but they don't have ACH. Okay, go figure. But Binance.us and Gemini.com definitely can transfer money back and forth between your bank account. And I like them. I like Binance. And if you do it early in the morning, if you initiate the transfer, like let's say before noonish or something, usually it'll be there the next day. Otherwise, it takes an extra day. So, yeah. I was thinking earlier today, when I used a long time ago, I used Coinbase. I don't use Coinbase at all, and I don't recommend them. I don't know if it's still the case. But it used to be that you would go on Coinbase and you'd be like, oh, okay, I want to buy, you know, $100, $500, whatever, worth of crypto, Bitcoin. Boom, I buy $500 worth of Bitcoin. Enter. Boom, they take your money. Your Bitcoin will be delivered to you in your wallet, and then they give you some date in the future. Like a week. It's like, no, I want it now. I paid you. You took my money. I want my, no, you got to wait a week. That kind of crap. I don't know if they still do that anymore. Anyway, I'm going to take a sip of this apple juice. All right. Now, that was my last ado, I think. Let me make sure that everything here is ready. Yes. Good. And now, the Fulford Report. Geopolitical megaquake ready to blow. While the Western world wanders through the dystopia of a fake Joe Biden presidency and a manufactured pandemic, something huge is brewing. A thousand-year-old regime is facing systematic collapse, and secret negotiations about its replacement are ongoing. We cannot talk in detail about the negotiations yet for security reasons. All we can say is that it will be the biggest thing since monotheism began in ancient Egypt thousands of years ago. When it happens, it will be on all the screens and news outlets. Until then, operational secrecy is vital. So let's look at the signs of systematic collapse. The biggest thing visible is hyperinflation emerging in the U.S. This is something commonly seen during regime collapse. The cause is the people behind the Biden avatar printing money like there is no tomorrow, for them is probably true. Government handouts exploded in March to an annualized $8.1 trillion, doubled the $4.1 trillion from February and $5 trillion above the pre-pandemic level of $3.2 trillion. This is what it has done to commodity prices over the last year, even though the party has just barely started. Lumber and WTI crude up over 200%. Corn, copper, soybeans, silver, sugar, cotton, platinum, palladium, all up great numbers, as well as wheat and coffee. Supply chain experts say they have never seen anything like what is now happening. Quote, there is a total logjam. Goods cannot be shipped in some cases, and supply-side inflation is on a scale we have not seen for a long, long time. Looks imminent. There is also a food shortage emerging in the United States, with food prices rising and basic items like chicken meat running in short supply. As of last December, one in seven U.S. households was suffering food shortages. By January, 41.8 million Americans were on food stamps. That's 13% more than a year earlier. Meanwhile, all of the Biden funny money being handed out to appease the masses is also removing their incentive to work. The situation has reached the point where McDonald's franchises are paying $50 to people to just show up for a job interview, and convenience store chains are paying $500 signing bonuses. How do we get enough drivers? I don't know, was the answer Covenant Logistics CEO David Parker gave analysts last week when asked about the labor. Uber insider Nathaniel Rothschild has given public hints to those who pay attention, tweeting such things as, "What if tomorrow the world changes as we know it? And the next crisis will hit you during your sleep, and you will wake up poor. It will happen lightning fast. Music is still playing. Few do realize that every market is deep faked. So prepare. Buy physical gold and silver." The question that needs to be asked in these circumstances is, why is the U.S. dollar so strong? The answer is, of course, is that Biden funny money is only being accepted inside the United States. In other words, the U.S. dollar is no longer American. The Chinese are lending the Biden regime real money to buy their stuff because Chinese-American Catherine Tai, the U.S. trade representative, is the de facto president of the United States, according to Asian Secret Society sources. Here is the avatar they are using for day-to-day interactions with the corporate propaganda media Jen Sakai, a.k.a. David Rockefeller's grandson, Mark Zuckerberg. What this family that sold the U.S. corporate government to China fails to realize is that, according to a senior European royal, all of the world's military intelligence agencies are allied and know what has happened. In other words, they know the West has been seized by a fanatic religious cult that is trying to vaccinate everyone on Earth with gene-altering substances in order to permanently enslave them. The agency sources say the decision at the top brass has been made to end this madness and get the world back to what was normal. Not this so-called new normal this cult of lunatics are ramming down the global civilian population's neck. Speaking about lunatics, the public dialogue about this pandemic and vaccine is getting weirder and weirder by the day. They are now saying things like, vaccinated people will contaminate the non-vaccinated. And we have so-called Pfizer executives saying things like, the vaccines will sterilize you, give you mad cow disease, turn you into an atheist, etc. While some of this is clearly fear porn, there can be no doubt that some of these vaccines really are murderous. In India, it has now become clear their recent breakout of new variants of COVID-19 was directly linked to vaccinations. This is why India's vaccine czar has left the country for the UK due to unprecedented threats. Then you have respected magazines like Scientific American noting how influenza has disappeared, but failing to reach the conclusion that it has disappeared because its name was changed to COVID-19. Influenza did not disappear in Japan because the medical system refused to lie about it. That is why the only COVID-19 cases in Japan come from hospitals owned by the Cabal Front KKR. The move to use the pandemic as an excuse for strict social control and vaccine passports is also connected to an attempt to initiate a Mark of the Beast type financial system. MasterCard, PayPal, Visa, all working with privately owned central banks now, tweets Rothschild. Here is the real explanation for the pandemic as forwarded to us by the CIA. Quote, the Chinese biological laboratory in Wuhan is owned by GlaxoSmithKline, which owns Pfizer. The one who makes the vaccine against the virus that started the Wuhan biological that started at the Wuhan biological lab was funded by Dr. Fauci, who promotes the vaccine. GlaxoSmithKline is managed by the finance division of BlackRock, which manages the finances of the Open Foundation company, a Soros Foundation, which manages the Soros-owned German company Winterthur that built a Chinese laboratory in Wuhan and was bought by the German Allianz company that coincidentally has Vanguard as a shareholder who coincidentally is a shareholder of BlackRock, which coincidentally controls central banks and manages about a third of global investment capital. BlackRock is also coincidentally a major shareholder of Microsoft, owned by Bill Gates, who coincidentally is a shareholder of Pfizer, which, remember, sells a miracle vaccine and coincidentally is now the first sponsor of the World Health Organization. Now you understand how a dead bat sold in a wet market in China has infected the whole planet. In some ways, this is all too contrived, which brings the question, what if this is all just a giant initiation ceremony? We were told last year that humanity would be put through the equivalent of a tribal coming-of-age ceremony, that the whole thing would last until the autumn of this year. The idea would be to implement the type of changes to a global governance usually involving a world war without actually having a world war. In a sign that this might be right, we are noticing more and more UFO and space opera stuff appearing in the mainstream corporate media. Here is a sampling from last week, with even the New Yorker magazine getting in on the action. And they have several links here. Daily Star, ISS cameras, film mystery, Skinwalker Ranch, UFO Pentagon cows mutilated. Scientists spot yet another unexplained ring-shaped radio structure in space. Actually, let's see if I can copy these for you. And I will throw all the links at once into the chat room. And let's go to the chat room here. Hang on. I'm hoping there's spaces. We're going to find out. So hopefully they all didn't run together. All right, now back to the report. In any case, while the West is going through its nervous breakdown and seeing UFOs, the rest of the world is busy redrawing borders. This is especially true in the Middle East. The big story there continues to be the ongoing attempt by the Turks to revive the Ottoman Empire. Here is the sort of talk they are publicly putting out. Quote, they are telling us to refrain from altering the post-World War I order, to remain as the West's Eastern Front, to avoid any action that will bring the region to us and awaken the main axis of the earth, which stretches from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast. Turkey is much more effective than all European countries put together. The West is no longer the world center. That's from Turkey, another country heard from. These words are being backed with military action in Libya, Iraq, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, etc. The country with the most to lose is the Israeli crypto colony of Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have no more power, even with all of that oil. They can't buy respect anymore, according to the CIA. In a desperate attempt to avoid a Turkish takeover, hang on, I'm getting, change something here. I'm getting these little bleeps. I don't know where they're coming from. Oh, I see where they're coming from. Okay. Goodbye. The Saudis, in a desperate attempt to avoid a Turkish takeover, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and other Gulf countries have been trying to make peace with Iran. We are seeking to have good relations with Iran, Saudi Crown Prince Avatar Mohammed bin Salman told Saudi television this week. The Sauds need to make peace with Iran because the U.S. military is no longer willing to act as their enforcers. That is why they are losing the war with Yemen's Houthis and are in real danger of losing control over their oil fields. The Yemeni people, who built 12-story tall buildings over a millennia ago, view the Saudis as upstart camel herders who just happened to get lucky with oil. They want to return their historical place as the true powers in the Arab Peninsula, and will probably succeed in doing so. The Saudi may soon get taken out of Arabia. The other country that is losing its border war is the United States. Sources along the frontier with Mexico say the border is disintegrating. I've never seen anything quite like this. It's the Wild West on steroids, says Goyland Border County Sheriff Roy Boyd. Canada is keeping its border with the U.S. mostly shut for now, but it is a good bet that a joint U.S.-Canadian military operation to remove satanic cultist Justin Castro from power is just a matter of time. At that point, the Biden-Rockefeller communist China freak show in the United States should also come tumbling down. There is a powerful group that wants to reinvigorate the West by restoring democracy, the rule of law, freedom of the press, and meritocracy. If the West fails in its efforts, the United States will become a Chinese-owned farm whose management is subcontracted to a bunch of Khazarian gangsters like the Rockefellers. Eventually, the entire planet will forever be turned into a giant animal farm. We all need to join the fight to make sure this never happens. We will win, but it will take a lot of hard work and brave determination. And that is the Fulford Report for the 6th of May, 2021.
I saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with the Queen, doing the werewolves of London. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada at Trader Vic's, and his hair was perfect.
Listeners and the hosts at
Revolution Radio.
Radio. Radio.
For allowing us to bring you a platform of free speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for staying with us. We now return to the King of Crypto, the Tarzan of Techno, the mystery wrapped up in a riddle, Mr. Rowe.
Ow-roo. Yes. I sometimes howl. I haven't howled. I howled the other day. I howled at the moon the other night. Hey, I guess we will go ahead and continue with the rest, well, with at the 250-minute mark of 1984, unless we have massive opposition to that voiced in the chat room or something. But, yeah, I think that's what we'll do. Let me think real quick if there was anything. Oh, yes. It's probably actually on YouTube. Jimmy Jean's Into the Microcosm there. I am with Jimmy every Monday evening for Mr. Rowe's Alternative Universe. So if you want, on this next Monday evening, I think it is 10:30. Pacific time, 10:30 p.m. at night, 10:30 p.m. Pacific time on Monday. And this Monday, we're going to be talking about San Francisco and the 1849 gold rush and the city itself and the origins of the city and some of the anomalies that had been found. I did a show like that on this network, on this program. And so we'll probably revisit a lot of that. We'll be on YouTube. So we'll have visual aids. Yes, we'll have visual aids. So you can follow along and sit back and just stare at your screen while we give you possibilities of things. Yeah. Okay, so let's find the 250-minute mark here. Oh, actually, let's find the right file. How about that? There we go. This is part one. It is part one, and then there is part two. I don't think part two is as long, though. But let's go ahead.
1984 by George Orwell.
Yes, yes, yes. And we were 250 minutes in, more or less. 230, 240, 250-ish. All right, 249, 250. There we go. Okay, so I will probably be back either for some sort of roundtable at some point in time or, of course, on Sunday for
the Row Lounge, which is our 1 hour of decompress, chill, Sunday afternoon, melodic trance, and just, you know, chill out and listen to the sounds of groovy music. And that's it. So I will bid you adieu for this show and continue now with 1984.
He had brought an envelope full of victory coffee and some saccharin tablets. The clock's hands said 7:20. It was 19:20, really. She was coming at 19:30. Folly. Folly, his heart kept saying. Conscious, gratuitous, suicidal folly. Of all the crimes that a party member could commit, this one was the least possible to conceal. Actually, the idea had first floated into his head in the form of a vision of the glass paperweight mirrored by the surface of the gate-leg table. As he had foreseen, Mr. Charrington had made no difficulty about letting the room. He was obviously glad of the few dollars that it would bring him. Nor did he seem shocked or become offensively knowing when it was made clear that Winston wanted the room for the purpose of a love affair. Instead, he looked into the middle distance and spoke in generalities, with so delicate an air as to give the impression that he had become partly invisible. Privacy, he said, was a very valuable thing. Everyone wanted a place where they could be alone occasionally, and when they had such a place it was only common courtesy in anyone else who knew of it to keep his knowledge to himself. He even, seeming almost to fade out of existence as he did so, added that there were two entries to the house, one of them through the backyard, which gave on an alley. Under the window somebody was singing. Winston peeped out, secure in the protection of a muslin curtain. The June sun was still high in the sky, and in the sun-filled court below a monstrous woman solid as a Norman pillar, with brawny red forearms and a sacking apron strapped about her middle, was stumping to and fro between a wash-tub and a clothesline, pegging out a series of square, white things which Winston recognised as baby's diapers. Whenever her mouth was not corked with clothes pegs, she was singing in a powerful contralto, "It was only an hopeless fancy, it passed like an April dye, but a look and a word and the dreams they stirred, they have stolen my heart away." The tune had been haunting London for weeks past. It was one of countless similar songs published for the benefit of the proles by a subsection of the music department. The words of these songs were composed without any human intervention whatever on an instrument known as a versificator. But the woman sang so tunefully as to turn the dreadful rubbish into an almost pleasant sound. He could hear the woman singing and the scrape of her shoes on the flagstones and the cries of the children in the street, and somewhere in the far distance a faint roar of traffic. And yet the room seemed curiously silent, thanks to the absence of a telescreen. Folly, 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 he thought again. It was inconceivable that they could frequent this place for more than a few weeks without being caught. But the temptation of having a hiding-place that was truly their own, indoors and near at hand, had been too much for both of them. For some time after their visit to the church belfry, it had been impossible to arrange meetings. Working hours had been drastically increased in anticipation of Hate Week. It was more than a month distant, but the enormous, complex preparations that it entailed were throwing extra work onto everybody. Finally, both of them managed to secure a free afternoon on the same day. They had agreed to go back to the clearing in the wood. On the evening beforehand, they met briefly in the street. As usual, Winston hardly looked at Julia as they drifted toward one another in the crowd, but from the short glance he gave her, it seemed to him that she was paler than usual. "It's all off," she murmured as soon as she judged it safe to speak. "Tomorrow, I mean." "What?" "Tomorrow afternoon. I can't come."
"Why not?"
"Oh, the usual reason. It started early this time." For a moment he was violently angry. During the month that he had known her, the nature of his desire for her had changed. At the beginning there had been little true sensuality in it. Their first love-making had been simply an act of the will. But after the second time it was different. The smell of her hair, the taste of her mouth, the feeling of her skin seemed to have got inside him, or into the air all round him. She had become a physical necessity, something that he not only wanted but felt that he had a right to. When she said that she could not come, he had the feeling that she was cheating him. But just at this moment the crowd pressed them together and their hands accidentally met. She gave the tips of his fingers a quick squeeze that seemed to invite not desire but affection. It struck him that when one lived with a woman, this particular disappointment must be a normal, recurring event, and a deep tenderness, such as he had not felt for her before, suddenly took hold of him.
He wished that they were a married couple of 10 years standing. He wished that he were walking through the streets with her just as they were doing now, but openly and without fear, talking of trivialities and buying odds and ends for the household. He wished above all that they had some place where they could be alone together, without feeling the obligation to make love every time they met. It was not actually at that moment, but at some time on the following day, that the idea of renting Mr. Charrington's room had occurred to him. When he suggested it to Julia, she had agreed with unexpected readiness. Both of them knew that it was lunacy. It was as though they were intentionally stepping nearer to their graves. As he sat waiting on the edge of the bed, he thought again of the cellars of the Ministry of Love. It was curious how that predestined horror moved in and out of one's consciousness. There it lay, fixed in future time, preceding death as surely as 99 precedes 100. One could not avoid it, but one could perhaps postpone it, and yet instead every now and again, by a conscious, willful act, one chose to shorten the interval before it happened. At this moment there was a quick step on the stairs. Julia burst into the room. She was carrying a tool bag of coarse brown canvas, such as he had sometimes seen her carrying to and fro at the ministry. He started forward to take her in his arms, but she disengaged herself rather hurriedly, partly because she was still holding the tool bag. "Half a second," she said. "Just let me show you what I've brought. Did you bring some of that filthy Victory coffee? I thought you would. You can chuck it away again, because we shan't be needing it. Look here." She fell on her knees, threw open the bag, and tumbled out some spanners and a screwdriver that filled the top part of it. Underneath was a number of neat paper packets. The first packet that she passed to Winston had a strange and yet vaguely familiar feeling. It was filled with some kind of heavy, sand-like stuff which yielded wherever you touched it. "It isn't sugar," he said. "Real sugar, not saccharine, sugar. And here's a loaf of bread, proper white bread, not our bloody stuff, and a little pot of jam. And here's a tin of milk. But look, this is the one I'm really proud of. I had to wrap a bit of sacking round it because..." But she did not need to tell him why she had wrapped it up. The smell was already filling the room, a rich, hot smell which seemed like an emanation from his early childhood, but which one did occasionally meet with even now, blowing down a passageway before a door slammed, or diffusing itself mysteriously in a crowded street, sniffed for an instant, and then lost again. "It's coffee," he murmured. "Real coffee." "It's inner party coffee. There's a whole kilo here," she said. "How did you manage to get hold of all these things?" "It's all inner party stuff. There's nothing those swine don't have, nothing. But, of course, waiters and servants and people pinch things, and look, I've got a little packet of tea as well." Winston had squatted down beside her. He tore open a corner of the packet. "It's real tea, not blackberry leaves." "There's been a lot of tea about lately. They've captured India or something," she said vaguely. "But listen, dear, I want you to turn your back on me for 3 minutes. Go and sit on the other side of the bed. Don't go too near the window, and don't turn round till I tell you." Winston gazed abstractedly through the muslin curtain. Down in the yard, the red-armed woman was still marching to and fro between the wash-tub and the line. She took two more pegs out of her mouth and sang with deep feeling, "They say that time heals all things. They say you can always forget. But the smiles and the tears across the years, they twist my heart-strings yet." She knew the whole drivelling song by heart, it seemed. Her voice floated upward with a sweet summer air, very tuneful, charged with a sort of happy melancholy. One had the feeling that she would have been perfectly content if the June evening had been endless and the supply of clothes inexhaustible, to remain there for 1,000 years, pegging out diapers and singing rubbish. It struck him as a curious fact that he had never heard a member of the party singing alone and spontaneously. It would even have seemed slightly unorthodox, a dangerous eccentricity, like talking to oneself. Perhaps it was only when people were somewhere near the starvation level that they had anything to sing about. "You can turn around now," said Julia. He turned round and for a second almost failed to recognise her. What he had actually expected was to see her naked. But she was not naked. The transformation that had happened was much more surprising than that. She had painted her face. She must have slipped into some shop in the proletarian quarters and bought herself a complete set of make-up materials. Her lips were deeply reddened, her cheeks rouged, her nose powdered. There was even a touch of something under the eyes to make them brighter. It was not very skillfully done, but Winston's standards in such matters were not high. He had never before seen or imagined a woman of the party with cosmetics on her face. The improvement in her appearance was startling. With just a few dabs of colour in the right places, she had become not only very much prettier, but above all far more feminine. Her short hair and boyish overalls merely added to the effect. As he took her in his arms, a wave of synthetic violets flooded his nostrils. He remembered the half-darkness of a basement kitchen and a woman's cavernous mouth. It was the very same scent that she had used, but at the moment it did not seem to matter. "Scent too," he said. "Yes, dear, scent too. And you know what I'm going to do next? I'm going to get hold of a real woman's frock from somewhere and wear it instead of these bloody trousers. I'll wear silk stockings and high-heeled shoes. In this room I'm going to be a woman, not a party comrade." They flung their clothes off and climbed into the huge mahogany bed. It was the first time that he had stripped himself naked in her presence. Until now he had been too much ashamed of his pale and meagre body, with the varicose veins standing out on his calves and the discoloured patch over his ankle. There were no sheets, but the blanket they lay on was threadbare and smooth, and the size and springiness of the bed astonished both of them. "It's sure to be full of bugs, but who cares?" said Julia. One never saw a double bed nowadays, except in the homes of the proles. Winston had occasionally slept in one in his boyhood. Julia had never been in one before, so far as she could remember. Presently they fell asleep for a little while. When Winston woke up, the hands of the clock had crept round to nearly nine. He did not stir because Julia was sleeping with her head in the crook of his arm. Most of her make-up had transferred itself to his own face or the bolster, but a light stain of rouge still brought out the beauty of her cheekbone. A yellow ray from the sinking sun fell across the foot of the bed and lighted up the fireplace, where the water in the pan was boiling fast. Down in the yard the women had stopped singing, but the faint shouts of children floated in from the street. He wondered vaguely whether in the abolished past it had been a normal experience to lie in bed like this, in the cool of a summer evening, a man and a woman with no clothes on, making love when they chose, talking of what they chose, not feeling any compulsion to get up, simply lying there and listening to peaceful sounds outside. Surely there could never have been a time when that seemed ordinary. Julia woke up, rubbed her eyes, and raised herself on her elbow to look at the oil stove. "Half that water's boiled away," she said. "I'll get up and make some coffee in another moment. We've got an hour. What time do they cut the lights off at your flats?"
23:30.
"It's 23 at the hostel, but you have to get in earlier than that because—" "Ah, get out, you filthy brute!"
She suddenly twisted herself over in the bed, seized a shoe from the floor, and sent it hurtling into the corner with a boyish jerk of her arm, exactly as he had seen her fling the dictionary at Goldstein that morning during the 2 minutes' hate.
"What was it?" he said in surprise. "A rat. I saw him stick his beastly nose out of the wainscoting. There's a hole down there. I gave him a good fright anyway."
"Rats," murmured Winston. "In this room?"
"They're all over the place," said Julia indifferently as she lay down again. "We've even got them in the kitchen at the hostel. Some parts of London are swarming with them. Did you know they attack children?" "Yes, they do. In some of these streets, a woman daren't leave a baby alone for 2 minutes. It's the great huge brown ones that do it. And the nasty thing is that the brutes always—"
"Don't go on," said Winston, with his eyes tightly shut.
"Dearest, you've gone quite pale. What's the matter? Do they make you feel sick?"
"Of all the horrors in the world, a rat!"
She pressed herself against him and wound her limbs round him, as though to reassure him with the warmth of her body. He did not reopen his eyes immediately. For several moments he had had the feeling of being back in a nightmare which had recurred from time to time throughout his life. It was always very much the same. He was standing in front of a wall of darkness, and on the other side of it there was something unendurable, something too dreadful to be faced. In the dream his deepest feeling was always one of self-deception, because he did in fact know what was behind the wall of darkness. With a deadly effort, like wrenching a piece out of his own brain, he could even have dragged the thing into the open. He always woke up without discovering what it was, but somehow it was connected with what Julia had been saying when he cut her short.
"I'm sorry," he said. "It's nothing. I don't like rats, that's all."
"Don't worry, dear, we're not going to have the filthy brutes in here. I'll stuff the hole with a bit of sacking before we go, and next time we come here I'll bring some plaster and bung it up properly."
Already the black instant of panic was half forgotten. Feeling slightly ashamed of himself,
He sat up against the bedhead. Julia got out of bed, pulled on her overalls, and made the coffee. The smell that rose from the saucepan was so powerful and exciting that they shut the window lest anybody outside should notice it and become inquisitive. What was even better than the taste of the coffee was the silky texture given to it by the sugar, a thing Winston had almost forgotten after years of saccharin. With one hand in her pocket and a piece of bread and jam in the other, Julia wandered about the room, glancing indifferently at the bookcase, pointing out the best way of repairing the gate-legged table, plumping herself down in the ragged armchair to see if it was comfortable, and examining the absurd 12-hour clock with a sort of tolerant amusement. She brought the glass paperweight over to the bed to have a look at it in a better light. She took it out of her hand, fascinated, as always, by the soft, rain-watery appearance of the glass. "What is it, do you think?" said Julia. "I don't think it's anything. I mean, I don't think it was ever put to any use. That's what I like about it. It's a little chunk of history that they've forgotten to alter. It's a message from 100 years ago, if one knew how to read it." "And that picture over there?" She nodded at the engraving on the opposite wall. "Would that be 100 years old?" "More. 200, I dare say. One can't tell. It's impossible to discover the age of anything nowadays." She went over to look at it. "Here's where that brute stuck his nose out," she said, kicking the wainscoting immediately below the picture. "What is this place? I've seen it before somewhere." "It's a church, or at least it used to be. St. Clement's Dane, its name was." The fragment of rhyme that Mr. Charrington had taught him came back into his head, and he added half nostalgically, "Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's." To his astonishment, she capped the line. "You owe me 3 farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. When will you pay me?" said the bells of Old Bailey. I can't remember how it goes on after that, but anyway, I remember it ends, "Here comes a candle to light you to bed, here comes a chopper to chop off your head." It was like the 2 halves of a countersign. But there must be another line after the bells of Old Bailey. Perhaps it could be dug out of Mr. Charrington's memory if he were suitably prompted. "Who taught you that?" he said. "My grandfather. He used to say it to me when I was a little girl. He was vaporized when I was 8. At any rate, he disappeared. I wonder what a lemon was," she added inconsequently. "I've seen oranges. They're a kind of round yellow fruit with a thick skin." "I can remember lemons," said Winston. "They were quite common in the 50s. They were so sour that it set your teeth on edge even to smell them." "I bet that picture's got bugs behind it," said Julia. "I'll take it down and give it a good cleaning some day. I suppose it's almost time we were leaving. I must start washing this paint off. What a bore. I'll get the lipstick off your face afterwards." Winston did not get up for a few minutes more. The room was darkening. He turned over toward the light and lay gazing into the glass paperweight. The inexhaustibly interesting thing was not the fragment of coral, but the interior of the glass itself. There was such a depth of it, and yet it was almost as transparent as air. It was as though the surface of the glass had been the arch of the sky, enclosing a tiny world with its atmosphere complete. He had the feeling that he could get inside it, and that in fact he was inside it, along with the mahogany bed and the gate-legged table and the clock and the steel engraving and the paperweight itself. The paperweight was the room he was in, and the coral was Julia's life and his own, fixed in a sort of eternity at the heart of the crystal. 5. Syme had vanished. A morning came, and he was missing from work. A few thoughtless people commented on his absence. On the next day, nobody mentioned him. On the third day, Winston went into the vestibule of the records department to look at the notice board. One of the notices carried a printed list of the members of the chess committee, of whom Syme had been one. It looked almost exactly as it had looked before. Nothing had been crossed out, but it was one name shorter. It was enough. Syme had ceased to exist. He had never existed. The weather was baking hot. In the labyrinthine ministry, the windowless, air-conditioned rooms kept their normal temperature, but outside the pavements scorched one's feet, and the stench of the tubes at the rush hours was a horror. The preparations for Hate Week were in full swing, and the staffs of all the ministries were working overtime. Processions, meetings, military parades, lectures, waxwork displays, film shows, telescreen programmes, all had to be organised. Stands had to be erected, effigies built, slogans coined, songs written, rumours circulated, photographs faked. Julia's unit in the fiction department had been taken off the production of novels and was rushing out a series of atrocity pamphlets. Winston, in addition to his regular work, spent long periods every day in going through back files of the Times and altering and embellishing news items which were to be quoted in speeches. Late at night, when crowds of rowdy proles roamed the streets, the town had a curiously febrile air. The rocket bombs crashed oftener than ever, and sometimes in the far distance there were enormous explosions which no one could explain and about which there were wild rumours. The new tune, which was to be the theme song of Hate Week, the Hate Song, it was called, had already been composed and was being endlessly plugged on the telescreens. It had a savage, barking rhythm which could not exactly be called music, but which resembled the beating of a drum. Roared out by hundreds of voices to the tramp of marching feet, it was terrifying. The proles had taken a fancy to it, and in the midnight streets it competed with a still popular It Was Only a Hopeless Fancy. The parson's children played it at all hours of the night and day, unbearably, on a comb and a piece of toilet paper. Winston's evenings were fuller than ever. Squads of volunteers, organised by parsons, were preparing the street for Hate Week, stitching banners, painting posters, erecting flagstaffs on the roofs, and perilously slinging wires across the street for the reception of streamers. Parsons boasted that Victory Mansions alone would display 400 metres of bunting. He was in his native element and as happy as a lark. The heat and the manual work had even given him a pretext for reverting to shorts and an open shirt in the evenings. He was everywhere at once, pushing, pulling, sawing, hammering, improvising, jollying everyone along with comradely exhortations and giving out from every fold of his body what seemed an inexhaustible supply of acrid-smelling sweat. A new poster had suddenly appeared all over London. It had no caption and represented simply the monstrous figure of a Eurasian soldier 3 or 4 metres high, striding forward with expressionless Mongolian face and enormous boots, a submachine gun pointed from his hip. From whatever angle you looked at the poster, the muzzle of the gun, magnified by the foreshortening, seemed to be pointed straight at you. The thing had been plastered on every blank space on every wall, even outnumbering the portraits of Big Brother. The proles, normally apathetic about the war, were being lashed into one of their periodical frenzies of patriotism. As though to harmonise with the general mood, the rocket bombs had been killing larger numbers of people than usual. One fell on a crowded film theatre in Stepney, burying several hundred victims among the ruins. The whole population of the neighbourhood turned out for a long, trailing funeral which went on for hours and was, in effect, an indignation meeting. Another bomb fell on a piece of waste ground which was used as a playground, and several dozen children were blown to pieces. There were further angry demonstrations. Goldstein was burned in effigy. Hundreds of copies of the poster of the Eurasian soldier were torn down and added to the flames, and a number of shops were looted in the turmoil. Then a rumour flew round that spies were directing the rocket bombs by means of wireless waves, and an old couple who were suspected of being of foreign extraction had their house set on fire and perished of suffocation. In the room over Mr. Charrington's shop, when they could get there, Julia and Winston lay side by side on a stripped bed under the open window, naked for the sake of coolness. The rat had never come back, but the bugs had multiplied hideously in the heat. It did not seem to matter, dirty or clean, the room was paradise. As soon as they arrived, they would sprinkle everything with pepper bought on the black market, tear off their clothes and make love with sweating bodies, then fall asleep and wake to find that the bugs had rallied and were massing for the counter-attack. 4, 5, 6, 7 times they met during the month of June. Winston had dropped his habit of drinking gin at all hours. He seemed to have lost the need for it. He had grown fatter. His varicose ulcer had subsided, leaving only a brown stain on the skin above his ankle. His fits of coughing in the early morning had stopped. The process of life had ceased to be intolerable. He had no longer any impulse to make faces at the telescreen or shout curses at the top of his voice. Now that they had a secure hiding place, almost a home, it did not even seem a hardship that they could only meet infrequently and for a couple of hours at a time. What mattered was that the room over the junk shop should exist. To know that it was there, inviolate, was almost the same as being in it. The room was a world, a pocket of the past where extinct animals could walk. Mr. Charrington, thought Winston, was another extinct animal. He usually stopped to talk with Mr. Charrington for a few minutes on his way upstairs. The old man seemed seldom or never to go out of doors, and on the other hand, to have almost no customers. He led a ghost-like existence between the tiny dark shop and an even tinier back kitchen where he prepared his meals, and which contained, among other things, an unbelievably ancient gramophone with an enormous horn. He seemed glad of the opportunity to talk. Wandering about among his worthless stock, with his long nose and thick spectacles and his bowed shoulders in the velvet jacket, he had always vaguely the air of being a collector rather than a tradesman. With a sort of faded enthusiasm, he would finger this scrap of rubbish or that, a china bottle stopper, the painted lid of a broken snuff-box, a pinchbeck locket containing a strand of some long-dead baby's hair, never asking that Winston should buy it, merely that he should admire it. To talk to him was like listening to the tinkling of a worn-out musical box. He had dragged out from the corners of his memory some more fragments of forgotten rhymes. There was one about 4-and-20 blackbirds, and another about a cow with a crumpled horn, and another about the death of poor Cock Robin. "It just occurred to me you might be interested," he would say with a deprecating little laugh whenever he produced a new fragment, but he could never recall more than a few lines of any one rhyme. Both of them knew, in a way it was never out of their minds, that what was now happening could not last long. There were times when the fact of impending death seemed as palpable as the bed they lay on, and they would cling together with a sort of despairing sensuality, like a damned soul grasping at his last morsel of pleasure when the clock is within 5 minutes of striking. But there were also times when they had the illusion not only of safety, but of permanence. So long as they were actually in this room, they both felt, no harm could come to them. Getting there was difficult and dangerous, but the room itself was sanctuary. It was as when Winston had gazed into the heart of the paperweight, with the feeling that it would be possible to get inside that glassy world, and that once inside it, time could be arrested. Often they gave themselves up to daydreams of escape. Their luck would hold indefinitely, and they would carry on their intrigue just like this for the remainder of their natural lives. Or Catherine would die, and by subtle manoeuvrings Winston and Julia would succeed in getting married. Or they would commit suicide together. Or they would disappear, alter themselves out of recognition, learn to speak with proletarian accents, get jobs in a factory, and live out their lives undetected in a back street. It was all nonsense, as they both knew. In reality, there was no escape. Even the one plan that was practicable, suicide, they had no intention of carrying out. To hang on from day to day and from week to week, spinning out a present that had no future, seemed an unconquerable instinct, just as one's lungs will always draw the next breath so long as there is air available. Sometimes, too, they talked of engaging in active rebellion against the party, but with no notion of how to take the first step. Even if the fabulous brotherhood was a reality, there still remained the difficulty of finding one's way into it. He told her of the strange intimacy that existed, or seemed to exist, between himself and O'Brien, and of the impulse he sometimes felt simply to walk into O'Brien's presence, announce that he was the enemy of the party, and demand his help. Curiously enough, this did not strike her as an impossibly rash thing to do. She was used to judging people by their faces, and it seemed natural to her that Winston should believe O'Brien to be trustworthy on the strength of a single flash of the eyes. Moreover, she took it for granted that everyone, or nearly everyone, secretly hated the party and would break the rules if he thought it safe to do so. But she refused to believe that widespread, organized opposition existed or could exist. The tales about Goldstein and his underground army, she said, were simply a lot of rubbish which the party had invented for its own purposes and which you had to pretend to believe in. Times beyond number, at party rallies and spontaneous demonstrations, she had shouted at the top of her voice for the execution of people whose names she had never heard, and in whose supposed crimes she had not the faintest belief. When public trials were happening, she had taken her place in the detachments from the Youth League who surrounded the courts from morning to night, chanting at intervals, "Death to the traitors!" During the 2 minutes' hate, she always excelled all others in shouting insults at Goldstein. Yet she had only the dimmest idea of who Goldstein was and what doctrines he was supposed to represent. She had grown up since the Revolution and was too young to remember the ideological battles of the 50s and 60s. Such a thing as an independent political movement was outside her imagination, and in any case the party was invincible. It would always exist, and it would always be the same. You could only rebel against it by secret disobedience, or, at most, by isolated acts of violence, such as killing somebody, or blowing something up. In some ways, She was far more acute than Winston and far less susceptible to party propaganda. Once, when he happened in some connection to mention the war against Eurasia, she startled him by saying casually that in her opinion the war was not happening. The rocket bombs which fell daily on London were probably fired by the government of Oceania itself, just to keep people frightened. This was an idea that had literally never occurred to him. She also stirred a sort of envy in him by telling him that during the 2 minutes' hate, her great difficulty was to avoid bursting out laughing. But she only questioned the teachings of the party when they in some way touched upon her own life. Often she was ready to accept the official mythology, simply because the difference between truth and falsehood did not seem important to her. She believed, for instance, having learnt it at school, that the party had invented airplanes. In his own school days, Winston remembered, in the late 50s, it was only the helicopter that the party claimed to have invented. A dozen years later, when Julia was at school, it was already claiming the airplane. One generation more, and it would be claiming the steam engine. And when he told her that airplanes had been in existence before he was born, and long before the Revolution, the fact struck her as totally uninteresting. After all, what did it matter who had invented airplanes? It was rather more of a shock to him when he discovered from some chance remark that she did not remember that Oceania, 4 years ago, had been at war with East Asia and at peace with Eurasia. It was true that she regarded the whole war as a sham, but apparently she had not even noticed that the name of the enemy had changed. "I thought we'd always been at war with Eurasia," she said vaguely. It frightened him a little. The invention of airplanes dated from long before her birth, but the switch over in the war had happened only 4 years ago, well after she was grown up. He argued with her about it for perhaps a quarter of an hour. In the end, he succeeded in forcing her memory back until she did dimly recall that at one time East Asia and not Eurasia had been the enemy. But the issue still struck her as unimportant. "Who cares?" she said impatiently. "It's always one bloody war after another, and one knows the news is all lies anyway." Sometimes he talked to her of the records department and the impudent forgeries that he committed there. Such things did not appear to horrify her. She did not feel the abyss opening beneath her feet at the thought of lies becoming truths. He told her the story of Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford, and the momentous slip of paper which he had once held between his fingers. It did not make much impression on her. At first, indeed, she failed to grasp the point of the story. "Were they friends of yours?" she said. "No, I never knew them. They were inner party members. Besides, they were far older men than I was. They belonged to the old days before the Revolution. I barely knew them by sight." "Then what was there to worry about? People are being killed off all the time, aren't they?" He tried to make her understand. This was an exceptional case. It wasn't just a question of somebody being killed. "Do you realize that the past, starting from yesterday, has been actually abolished? If it survives anywhere, it's in a few solid objects with no words attached to them, like that lump of glass there. Already we know almost literally nothing about the Revolution and the years before the Revolution. Every record has been destroyed or falsified, every book has been rewritten, every picture has been repainted, every statue and street and building has been renamed, every date has been altered. And that process is continuing day by day and minute by minute. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. I know, of course, that the past is falsified, but it would never be possible for me to prove it, even when I did the falsification myself. After the thing is done, no evidence ever remains. The only evidence is inside my own mind, and I don't know with any certainty that any other human being shares my memories. Just in that one instance, in my whole life, I did possess actual concrete evidence after the event, years after it. And what good was that? It was no good, because I threw it away a few minutes later. But if the same thing happened today, I should keep it." "Well, I wouldn't," said Julia. "I'm quite ready to take risks, but only for something worthwhile, not for bits of old newspaper. What could you have done with it, even if you had kept it?" "Not much, perhaps. But it was evidence. It might have planted a few doubts here and there, supposing that I dared to show it to anybody. I don't imagine that we can alter anything in our own lifetime, but one can imagine little knots of resistance springing up here and there, small groups of people banding themselves together and gradually growing, and even leaving a few records behind so that the next generation can carry on where we leave off." "I'm not interested in the next generation, dear. I'm interested in us." "You're only a rebel from the waist downwards," he told her. She thought this brilliantly witty and flung her arms round him in delight. In the ramifications of party doctrine, she had not the faintest interest. Whenever he began to talk of the principles of Ingsoc, doublethink, the mutability of the past and the denial of objective reality, and to use newspeak words, she became bored and confused and said that she never paid any attention to that kind of thing. One knew that it was all rubbish, so why let oneself be worried by it? She knew when to cheer and when to boo, and that was all one needed. If he persisted in talking of such subjects, she had a disconcerting habit of falling asleep. She was one of those people who can go to sleep at any hour and in any position. Talking to her, he realized how easy it was to present an appearance of orthodoxy while having no grasp whatever of what orthodoxy meant. In a way, the world view of the party imposed itself most successfully on people incapable of understanding it. They could be made to accept the most flagrant violations of reality because they never fully grasped the enormity of what was demanded of them and were not sufficiently interested in public events to notice what was happening. By lack of understanding, they remained sane. They simply swallowed everything, and what they swallowed did them no harm because it left no residue behind, just as a grain of corn will pass undigested through the body of a bird. 6. It had happened at last. The expected message had come. All his life, it seemed to him, he had been waiting for this to happen. He was walking down the long corridor at the ministry, and he was almost at the spot where Julia had slipped the note into his hand when he became aware that someone larger than himself was walking just behind him. The person, whoever it was, gave a small cough, evidently as a prelude to speaking. Winston stopped abruptly and turned. It was O'Brien. At last they were face to face, and it seemed that his only impulse was to run away. His heart bounded violently. He would have been incapable of speaking. O'Brien, however, had continued forward in the same movement, laying a friendly hand for a moment on Winston's arm, so that the two of them were walking side by side. He began speaking with a peculiar, grave courtesy that differentiated him from the majority of inner party members. "I had been hoping for an opportunity of talking to you," he said. "I was reading one of your Newspeak articles in the Times the other day. You take a scholarly interest in Newspeak, I believe." Winston had recovered part of his self-possession. "Hardly scholarly," he said. "I'm only an amateur. It's not my subject. I've never had anything to do with the actual construction of the language." "But you write it very elegantly," said O'Brien. "That is not only my own opinion. I was talking recently to a friend of yours who is certainly an expert. His name has slipped my memory for the moment." Again Winston's heart stirred painfully. It was inconceivable that this was anything other than a reference to Syme. But Syme was not only dead, he was abolished, an unperson. Any identifiable reference to him would have been mortally dangerous. O'Brien's remark must obviously have been intended as a signal, a code word. By sharing a small act of thought crime, he had turned the two of them into accomplices. They had continued to stroll slowly down the corridor, but now O'Brien halted. With the curious, disarming friendliness that he always managed to put into the gesture, he resettled his spectacles on his nose. Then he went on. "What I had really intended to say was that in your article I noticed you had used two words which have become obsolete, but they have only become so very recently. Have you seen the 10th edition of the Newspeak Dictionary?"
"No," said Winston. "I didn't think it had been issued yet. We are still using the 9th in the records department."
"The 10th edition is not due to appear for some months, I believe, but a few advance copies have been circulated. I have one myself. It might interest you to look at it, perhaps."
"Very much so," said Winston, immediately seeing where this tended.
"Some of the new developments are most ingenious. The reduction in the number of verbs, that is the point that will appeal to you, I think. Let me see, shall I send a messenger to you with a dictionary? But I am afraid I invariably forget anything of that kind. Perhaps you could pick it up at my flat at some time that suited you. Wait, let me give you my address." They were standing in front of a telescreen. Somewhat absent-mindedly, O'Brien felt two of his pockets and then produced a small leather-covered notebook and a gold ink pencil. Immediately beneath the telescreen, in such a position that anyone who was watching at the other end of the instrument could read what he was writing, he scribbled an address, tore out the page, and handed it to Winston. "I am usually at home in the evenings," he said. "If not, my servant will give you the dictionary." He was gone, leaving Winston holding the scrap of paper, which this time there was no need to conceal. Nevertheless, he carefully memorized what was written on it, and some hours later dropped it into the memory hole, along with a mass of other papers.
They had been talking to one another for a couple of minutes at the most. There was only one meaning that the episode could possibly have. It had been contrived as a way of letting Winston know O'Brien's address. This was necessary, because except by direct inquiry, it was never possible to discover where anyone lived. There were no directories of any kind. "If you ever want to see me, this is where I can be found," was what O'Brien had been saying to him. Perhaps there would even be a message concealed somewhere in the dictionary. But at any rate, one thing was certain. The conspiracy that he had dreamed of did exist, and he had reached the outer edges of it. He knew that sooner or later he would obey O'Brien's summons, perhaps tomorrow. Perhaps after a long delay. He was not certain. What was happening was only the working out of a process that had started years ago. The first step had been a secret, involuntary thought. The second had been the opening of the diary. He had moved from thoughts to words, and now from words to actions. The last step was something that would happen in the Ministry of Love. He had accepted it. The end was contained in the beginning. But it was frightening. Or more exactly, it was like a foretaste of death, like being a little less alive. Even while he was speaking to O'Brien, when the meaning of the words had sunk in, a chilly, shuddering feeling had taken possession of his body. He had the sensation of stepping into the dampness of a grave, and it was not much better because he had always known that the grave was there and waiting for him.
7. Winston had woken up with his eyes full of tears. Julia rolled sleepily against him, murmuring something that might have been, "What's the matter?" "I dreamt..." he began, and stopped short. It was too complex to be put into words. There was the dream itself, and there was a memory connected with it that had swum into his mind in the few seconds after waking. He lay back with his eyes shut, still sodden in the atmosphere of the dream. It was a vast, luminous dream in which his whole life seemed to stretch out before him like a landscape on a summer evening after rain. It had all occurred inside the glass paperweight, but the surface of the glass was the dome of the sky, and inside the dome everything was flooded with clear, soft light in which one could see into interminable distances. The dream had also been comprehended by, indeed in some sense it had consisted in, a gesture of the arm made by his mother, and made again 30 years later by the Jewish woman he had seen on the news film, trying to shelter the small boy from the bullets before the helicopters blew them both to pieces. "Do you know," he said, "that until this moment I believed I had murdered my mother."
"Why did you murder her?"
said Julia, almost asleep. "I didn't murder her, not physically." In the dream he had remembered his last glimpse of his mother, and within a few moments of waking the cluster of small events surrounding it had all come back. It was a memory that he must have deliberately pushed out of his consciousness over many years. He was not certain of the date, but he could not have been less than 10 years old, possibly 12, when it had happened. His father had disappeared some time earlier. How much earlier he could not remember. He remembered better the rackety, uneasy circumstances of the time, the periodical panics about air raids and the sheltering in tube stations, the piles of rubble everywhere, the unintelligible proclamations posted at street corners, the gangs of youths in shirts all the same colour, the enormous queues outside the bakeries, the intermittent machine-gun fire in the distance, above all the fact that there was never enough to eat. He remembered long afternoons spent with other boys in scrounging round dustbins and rubbish heaps, picking out the ribs of cabbage leaves, potato peelings, sometimes even scraps of stale bread crust from which they carefully scraped away the cinders, and also in waiting for the passing of trucks which travelled over a certain route and were known to carry cattle feed, and which, when they jolted over the bad patches in the road, sometimes spilt a few fragments of oil cake. When his father disappeared, his mother did not show any surprise or any violent grief, but a sudden change came over her. She seemed to have become completely spiritless. It was evident even to Winston that she was waiting for something that she knew must happen. She did everything that was needed, cooked, washed, mended, made the bed, swept the floor, dusted the mantelpiece, always very slowly and with a curious lack of superfluous motion, like an artist's lay figure moving on its own accord. Her large, shapely body seemed to relapse naturally into stillness. For hours at a time she would sit almost immobile on the bed nursing his young sister, a tiny, ailing, very silent child of 2 or 3, with a face made simian by thinness. Very occasionally she would take Winston in her arms and press him against her for a long time without saying anything. He was aware, in spite of his youthfulness and selfishness, that this was somehow connected with the never-mentioned thing that was about to happen. He remembered the room where they lived, a dark, close-smelling room that seemed half-filled by a bed with a white counterpane. There was a gas ring in the fender, and a shelf where food was kept, and on the landing outside there was a brown earthenware sink common to several rooms. He remembered his mother's statuesque body bending over the gas ring to stir at something in a saucepan. Above all, he remembered his continuous hunger and the fierce, sordid battles at mealtimes. He would ask his mother naggingly, over and over again, why there was not more food. He would shout and storm at her. He even remembered the tones of his voice, which was beginning to break prematurely and sometimes boomed in a peculiar way. Or he would attempt a snivelling note of pathos in his efforts to get more than his share. His mother was quite ready to give him more than his share. She took it for granted that he, the boy, should have the biggest portion. But however much she gave him, he invariably demanded more. At every meal she would beseech him not to be selfish, and to remember that his little sister was sick and also needed food. But it was no use. He would cry out with rage when she stopped ladling. He would try to wrench the saucepan and spoon out of her hands. He would grab bits from his sister's plate. He knew that he was starving the other two, but he could not help it. He even felt that he had a right to do it. The clamorous hunger in his belly seemed to justify him. Between meals, if his mother did not stand guard, he was constantly pilfering at the wretched store of food on the shelf. One day a chocolate ration was issued. There had been no such issue for weeks or months past. He remembered quite clearly that precious little morsel of chocolate. It was a 2-ounce slab, they still talked about ounces in those days, between the three of them. It was obvious that it ought to be divided into three equal parts. Suddenly, as though he were listening to somebody else, Winston heard himself demanding in a loud, booming voice that he should be given the whole piece. His mother told him not to be greedy. There was a long, nagging argument that went round and round with shouts, whines, tears, remonstrances, bargainings. His tiny sister, clinging to her mother with both hands, exactly like a baby monkey, sat looking over her shoulder at him with large, mournful eyes. In the end, his mother broke off 3/4 of the chocolate and gave it to Winston, giving the other 1/4 to his sister. The little girl took hold of it and looked at it dully, perhaps not knowing what it was. Winston stood watching her for a moment, then with a sudden, swift spring he had snatched the piece of chocolate out of his sister's hand and was fleeing for the door. "Winston! Winston!" his mother called after him. "Come back! Give your sister back her chocolate!" He stopped, but he did not come back. His mother's anxious eyes were fixed on his face. Even now she was thinking about the thing, he did not know what it was, that was on the point of happening. His sister, conscious of having been robbed of something, had set up a feeble wail. His mother drew her arm round the child and pressed its face against her breast. Something in the gesture told him that his sister was dying. He turned and fled down the stairs with the chocolate growing sticky in his hand. He never saw his mother again. After he had devoured the chocolate, he felt somewhat ashamed of himself and hung about in the streets for several hours until hunger drove him home. When he came back, his mother had disappeared. This was already becoming normal at that time. Nothing was gone from the room except his mother and his sister. They had not taken any clothes, not even his mother's overcoat. To this day he did not know with any certainty that his mother was dead. It was perfectly possible that she had merely been sent to a forced labour camp. As for his sister, she might have been removed, like Winston himself, to one of the colonies for homeless children, reclamation centres they were called, which had grown up as a result of the Civil War. Or she might have been sent to the labour camp along with his mother, or simply left somewhere or other to die. The dream was still vivid in his mind, especially the enveloping, protecting gesture of the arm in which its whole meaning seemed to be contained. His mind went back to another dream of 2 months ago, exactly as his mother had sat on the dingy, white, quilted bed, with the child clinging to her, so she had sat in the sunken ship, far underneath him, and drowning deeper every minute, but still looking up at him through the darkening water. He told Julia the story of his mother's disappearance. Without opening her eyes, she rolled over and settled herself into a more comfortable position. "I expect you were a beastly little swine in those days,"
she said indistinctly. All children are swine. Yes, but the real point of the story... From her breathing, it was evident that she was going off to sleep again. He would have liked to continue talking about his mother. He did not suppose, from what he could remember of her, that she had been an unusual woman, still less an intelligent one, and yet she had possessed a kind of nobility, a kind of purity, simply because the standards that she obeyed were private ones. Her feelings were her own and could not be altered from outside. It would not have occurred to her that an action which is ineffectual thereby becomes meaningless. If you loved someone, you loved him, and when you had nothing else to give, you still gave him love. When the last of the chocolate was gone, his mother had clasped the child in her arms. It was no use. It changed nothing. It did not produce more chocolate. It did not avert the child's death or her own, but it seemed natural to her to do it. The refugee woman in the boat had also covered the little boy with her arm, which was no more use against the bullets than a sheet of paper. The terrible thing that the party had done was to persuade you that mere impulses, mere feelings, were of no account, while at the same time robbing you of all power over the material world. When once you were in the grip of the party, what you felt or did not feel, what you did or refrained from doing, made literally no difference. Whatever happened, you vanished.
Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back. I know.